we got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
An oppressed person will fight back.
Radio Basics.
And there's always a message involved.
What's up, Toronto? This is Radio Basics. We're back for another week. What do you got to say, Dave Chin?
My name is David Chin.
We're here to bring you another show this week on Radio Basics, CHRY 105.5. We got some international and some local news as usual. We're going to be interviewing Lucho Granado Ceja from Barrio Nuevo here in Toronto. It's a Latino organization here in Toronto. They've been doing some internationalist solidarity to try to get some recommission some old ambulances down to El Salvador, and their program almost got shut down today, and they had to pull off a mass action down at City Hall to ensure that their program wasn't shut down. And we're also going to be talking about the closure of schools here in Toronto. The TDSB is set to close down as many as 100 schools across Toronto in order to deal with its own budgetary crisis. We're going to get to the bottom of that, find out why is it these schools may be closed and how people can fight back. We're going to be interviewing a former 15-year school board, school trustee from the Jane and Finch area, Errol Young. And Chin, what do you got for us?
I got a critical analysis of what's going on in Haiti. There's a lot being said about disaster relief and the role the international community plays in, quote-unquote, helping Haiti get through this disastrous time. So we'd like to offer up a more of a critical critique. Is it ready for me to play there, Stevenson?
Yeah, we got it. And, you know, Radio Basics, we're always bringing the critical analysis, especially when it comes to Haiti. You know, that's an interesting Freudian slip, if you want to call it that right now, because, we laugh, but the situation ain't funny, right? We got to look at the role that Canada has been playing in Haiti for the last 6 years, since 2004, since President Jean-Bertrand Aristide was kidnapped at gunpoint by the Canadian, U.S. Military, the Marines, and as well as the French, when they invaded that country and put an end to the popular democratic movement that was unfolding there to challenge the situation, the poverty, the misery, the exploitation, right, of Haitians. So we're always bringing that analysis. People can check out our website at basicsnews.ca for more analysis on Haiti. And what's this piece you got for us, Chin?
It's an interview on, what's it called, RT, the Russian television
news?
I think something like that.
Yeah.
And it's what's his name?
Is it the Black Agenda Report?
Yeah, the Black Agenda Report. I can't remember his name, but I think it says it in the interview. So why don't we go ahead and play it?
All right.
Sending troops and aid, and all the reports we're hearing about is how it's a logistical nightmare and aid can't get in. But looking at what the Black Agenda Report is writing about, it looks like your paper has slightly different concerns about the U.S. relief effort in Haiti. What are your concerns?
The strength of a society is in its civil society. And one of the many ways that the United States basically set Haiti up for a disaster with which it could not cope is by suppressing Haitian civil society. A government that's not based on the will of the people is a hollow force. And it is no surprise then that under the blows of nature, the Haitian government would collapse. So we must look at the political aspect of Haiti, as well as the dire necessities of the moment.
Well,
and
that
means
empowering
civil society.
Tell us why you think the U.S. Is responsible for that.
Well, the United States didn't even recognize Haiti's independence until Abraham Lincoln was in office. Haiti, of course, was the first black republic, the first black republic on the face of the earth, winning its independence in a bloody war with France in 1804. It was immediately saddled with a debt of 150 million gold francs by France. Otherwise, the alternative would have been to be reinvaded by France. The United States stood by France in that obligation on the part of the Haitians to make whole the French plantation owners. It took Haiti 100 years to pay back that debt. The United States constantly interfered with Haiti after recognizing its independence, seizing control of its ports, collecting the duties as if it were sovereign. It invaded Haiti in 1915 and didn't leave until 1934, and then backed a succession of oligarchs and kleptocrats who bled the country dry with United States support. And
Mr.
finally,
Ford.
When the Haitians...
Let's talk about going from that history that you were talking about, which is an important part to discuss. Let's talk about now the current day. After this huge disaster, now the U.S. and international relief efforts are beginning. What do you think of these efforts that are underway and the troubles they're encountering?
Well, the troubles they are encountering are caused by the bottlenecks that are due to the collapse of the Haitian government, but the collapse of the infrastructure. We have to understand that there will always be earthquakes, there will always be hurricanes and floods, but the damage to people is predicated on the state of the infrastructure. For example, in 2008, a series of hurricanes in quick succession hit Haiti and resulted in officially 800 deaths. In Cuba, which is only a few miles away across the narrow strait of water, only 12 people died from the same hurricanes. That's because of the state of the infrastructure of Haiti. To involve the people, to recover from these hammer blows from nature, we must set loose civil society, and that means bringing back the most popular politician from by far the most popular political party. That politician is Aristide, John Bertrand Aristide, who was sent into exile by the United States in 2004. So empower the Haitian people to help rebuild their own country. That and $100 million can go a long way.
Mr. Ford, now former presidents George W. Bush and Bill Clinton are spearheading fundraising efforts to help with the recovery process in Haiti. What do you think about that based on their administration's policy on Haiti's when they were in office?
Well, Bill Clinton brought to Haiti devastating structural adjustments that basically put the coup de grace on the Haitian peasant class, moving Haiti from bare sufficiency in agriculture, in feeding itself, to total dependence on U.S. imports. That, of course, swelled the population of Port-au-Prince, the capital, to ridiculous proportions, and made the country totally dependent before the earthquake on U.S. Corporations and U.S. largesse. So certainly if there's going to be a recovery, it must be based on moving the Haitian people to self-sufficiency, at least in agriculture. That's something the United States can do, but it should be part of that recovery effort.
Well,
the United States can also stop deporting Haitians in such large numbers as they do today.
Well, Mr. Ford, certainly some really interesting ideas and very different than just the current crisis that we're talking about. You're talking about what has endured for some time, and we thank you very much for sharing your views. We'll continue to follow this story.
Radio Basics, CHY 105.5, we're back. That was Glenn Ford from the Black Agenda Report talking about the situation in Haiti and providing some historical context in order for people to understand the social situation that preceded the devastating earthquake that struck Haiti on January 12th, 3 weeks ago now. That situation is vital to understand if we are to get behind the causes of what's estimated to be 200,000 deaths in Haiti. Chin, you got a track for us?
Yeah, I got a really good track, actually, on George Jackson, a personal favorite of mine and yours, right, Stephen?
I've heard this track once or twice before.
I meant George Jackson's personal favorite.
Oh, George Jackson. Yes, he is one of my favorite, what can I say, revolutionary theorists, you know, big inspiration. People, if you don't know George Jackson, he probably wrote one of the most influential pieces of prison writing, maybe ever.
Him and Gramsci.
Next to Antonio Gramsci, but certainly in the North American tradition. This is George Jackson by Steel Pulse. Check it out.
This is CHRY 105.5 FM.
And this is Radio Basics. We're back. On CHRY 105.5 FM. What's going on, Chin?
Nothing.
So
doing a radio show.
Tell who is George Jackson for those who just heard that song by Steel Pulse?
Some guy.
Which guy? Which, by the way, Steel Pulse was a very influential reggae roots band out of the UK. That one of their first tracks was called Ku Klux Klan, just to give you a sense of their political consciousness and orientation. I doubt it was extolling the Ku Klux Klan, so people should check that out. But George Jackson, for those who may not know, just to provide a little bit of historical context, was a very influential theorist and thinker for the black revolutionary movement in the early 1970s. He was shot down and assassinated in San Quentin, was it?
Yep.
San Quentin prison in California in August 21st, 1971, if I'm not mistaken. And his assassination gave rise to, I believe, the largest prison rebellion in U.S. history. Yeah. On the other side of the states, in Attica, in upstate New York.
Yeah.
The largest prison rebellion where prisoners, conscious of the role that George Jackson was playing for the progressive prison movement, for the prison liberation movement, and also for black people, generally speaking, throughout the United States and across the world, gave rise to the largest rebellion. That rebellion, just as an interesting historical fact, which people may not be aware of, one of the demands of the prisoners was that they refused to negotiate the terms of the end of their rebellion with anybody except Richard Nixon, the president at the time, and they demanded that the revolutionary leader of China at the time, Mao Zedong, come in and be the only person that was able to broker a deal between them and the president of the United States. The rebellion was ultimately put down by violent and bloody force by U.S. authorities, but it's quite interesting that just to give you a sense of how influential that one individual was. And the role that he was playing at that time in the United States.
Even from inside of prison cell.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we have Angela Davis coming here to York in 2 days. Mm. And Angela Davis also a very good comrade of George Jackson. Mm-hmm. And you can learn a lot about, in fact, one of the reasons that Angela Davis ended up getting pinned up with charges on trumped up charges back in the 60s, which led her to be underground for a period of time, was allegedly for the relationship that she had with not only the Black Panthers but the Jackson family.
Yep.
So you should check that out. You can find out. You're going to find a lot of garbage if you do the Wikipedia search, but dig a little deeper, read some Panther books, and you can find out. Moving on to our local section of the news today on Radio Basics and also our feature-length interview today, we're going to be speaking with Errol Young, a former trustee here in Toronto, 15-year trustee out of the Jane and Finch area. And what we're going to be talking about today is the TDSB's plans, which are currently rolling out and in action in full force, to close as many as 100 schools here in Toronto, and certainly no less than a few dozen. Errol Young, he's on the line with us tonight. How are you, Errol?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, thank you for coming on the line with us tonight.
No problem.
So by way of introduction, I know you might have missed it, but we were just telling our audience here that about the school closures that are going to be unfolding in Toronto, the TDSB's yep. plans to close as many as 100 schools. Why is the TDSB looking to close this many schools here in Toronto?
Well, there are reasons that they talk about, and there are probably reasons that they don't talk about. The reason mm-hmm. they talk about is the fact that they've got a $2 billion capital deficit. Those are boilers, roofs. You know, toilets, they have to fix those things. They haven't got the money. The province is supposed to be funding the school boards. They're not funding the school boards enough. So the board keeps pulling money out of the capital part of it and putting it into programs.
Mm-hmm. So the fiscal
catching up to them.
So the fiscal situation that the TDSB is in extends beyond the TDSB, obviously. This has to do with funding.
Yeah. Now, every board is coming up. Every board has issues, like the separate school board, and all through the GTA, London, Ontario. You know, they all have problems like this. Now they come to the community, and they say to the community, we have to reorganize. The school population is shrinking. School population is shrinking. Oh, it's not shrinking that much, in actual fact. What's happening to the school population is it's going through a cycle. And mm-hmm. it takes 10 years up, 10 years down, maybe 12 up and down and up and down. And it's sort of rebounding from the baby boomers.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no way the classrooms that they have are going to go to waste. I mean, eventually they're going to need them.
Yeah, so is the student population actually shrinking, or is it that its growth is receding right now?
Yeah, in like in Jane Finch, they show that, that among the five schools that they're looking at, which are middle school and four elementary schools, the population has gone down by 500 or so. You know, and so and so it, it that sounds like a lot, but it's when you split it up per classrooms, they're still need a lot of classrooms for the remaining kids. So it, it, what they've come up with the way to do this, you know, the way to shut get to sell a school, they got to shut it, and the way and they've come up with a new new grade reorganization. They say, well, we got to be a K-8. You have to be a kindergarten to grade 8. Most schools in my area are kindergarten to grade 5. And the middle schools are 6 to 8s, and the high schools are high schools. So they're saying we gotta do this in order to give kids proper education. Also, it stops transitions. You know, transition from when you go from grade 5 to grade 6, you have to change schools. Well, no real parents really don't find that much of a problem. Kids are changing schools with their whole cohort of, you know, their grade. And they find it rather exciting, actually. Most kids, some kids fall through the cracks, but some kids fall through the cracks no matter what system you have.
Now,
so they say, but one, well, let me just say, in Jane Finch, they're going to be closing Shoreham Public School, which is sort of in Brookview Middle School's backyard, and putting the kids in Brookview, but Brookview's packed. Too many kids, right? So we're, you know, so they have to get the they have to get the majority of the 68s out of Brookview. They're going to be putting them in the local schools, into Driftwood, Gosford, and Blacksmith. So you're going to have these adolescents going into these schools that are specifically made for what are called primary and junior kids.
What are some of the problems that this poses?
Well, you know, think of the downgrading of the facility. You know, a middle school has home ec places, art classes, music areas.
Shop,
they have all these shops. They don't use shops too much, but they've got these things.
Yeah.
They got gyms with showers because the kids, when their hormones are going wild, they smell. You know, you need showers in them. And they have larger gyms. And they will not have those facilities in small areas. Well, the board comes back to them and say, oh, we're gonna improve it. We're gonna put money into them. And they say, wait a second, you started this whole process because there's no money. Right? Where are you gonna get the money? Even if you sell Shoreham, you know, it's right next to the tennis courts and stuff. It's, you know, you could build a hotel there for the tennis courts. Even if you sell Shoreham, that money's going to go into repair a boiler down on Bloor Street.
So, what's really behind this process? Why is it that they're deciding to close 100 schools?
Well,
what is the interest?
I think they've got a pressure. It's a plan by the province to you know, just get these public assets that are sitting out there and put them into private hands. That's how they see the economy working well, instead of seeing that public assets should remain public. I mean, they're doing it all over the world, people.
That's right. All over the world, all over Canada, Toronto.
Water is a big thing.
The LCBO is also on the chopping block.
Sure, right? A profitable enterprise, and they want to put it into private hands because, well, it probably should be in there. And look, we'll make a temporary windfall. I mean, you know, they sold the 407 for a song, and now the fees keep going up and up and up, and the province has absolutely no control over it, and it's sold to a foreign buyer. I mean, there are people going around with almost this religion of neoliberalism. They believe it must happen. It must. They say, oh, we were crazy back in the 60s buying all this land, creating all these schools, you know. In the 80s, we had to close a lot of those schools, but we kept the land. Why the hell didn't we sell them then? You know, they can't see it. They believe in taking community resources and putting it in the hands of the rich.
Now, I understand that there's a lot of opposition in communities developing to these closures or proposed closures.
Some organized, some unorganized.
That's right. And I understand that the TDSB has a so-called consultative process that they're calling the Accommodation Review Committee.
Yeah.
What's
these
that all about? What is that?
Committees have members from each school, two members from each school, usually appointed by their parent body. And they and so these the anyway, they hold a series of four public art meetings and private meetings, as it turns out. And they're basically convincing the parents. They go up to these parents and say, you got no choice. You got to vote to close Shoreham or whatever school is focused. That's the only choice you have. And the parents, after, you know, getting this over and over again, it's like a curriculum drilled into their head. Mm-hmm. They agree to it, or they don't. If they don't agree to it, the board can do it anyways.
So they're basically manufacturing consent here.
They're manufacturing consent, exactly.
I know that they've been running the same type of process in Toronto Community Housing in relation to revitalization projects, which are really gentrification and demolition projects, where they have these consultative meetings where they basically tell people to, you know, sit in a room, they break them down into groups of five, and they basically make the proposal to them saying that you have no other option, but you get to choose which side of the street the new parquet is going to be on.
Well, they tried to break a public ARC meeting into smaller groups. That was December 5th? Well, it was in January 3rd or something like that. They tried to break down us into smaller groups. The whole audience refused to break into smaller groups. The board was so rigid in this process, they basically shut down the meeting. They couldn't stand it.
Sorry, keep going.
Yeah. So they shut down the meeting. 300 people were sent home because they were saying things the board didn't want to hear.
Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of resistance is being offered up to this the ARC process and what the TDSB is trying to do in Toronto?
Well, there's
so far
small resistance all over the city. Jane Finch happens to be the most organized, and it's getting through the board. The board is doing a really stupid thing. They're doing this intensive anti-community program in an election year.
Mm-hmm.
So there's now a movement at the board level to freeze it for a year. Because after they're all reelected, they'll be able to do whatever the hell they like for the next 4 years.
It'll be far easier to push them through.
Oh, yeah, so. Yeah. Well, there won't be any consequences. Half of them will say, well, I don't think I'll run again.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
So how is it that I know that you're involved in mobilizing against the closures.
Sure.
I know you have a blog. You're part of some organizations. Can you tell some people about that and how people can plug in?
Well, I'm right at the meeting now of Jane Finch Action Against Poverty.
Okay.
And we're putting on a good food display on the Yorkgate Mall 4 till 7 tomorrow.
Okay.
Come down. You get a free meal, and you get some information about healthy food.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully doing some radicalization around food. So that's one of the things happening with JFAP. But they're also supporting school closure, you know, the resistance. We have a Save Our School Committee. It doesn't meet that much, but it talks during other meetings. And that's what's basically how we're basically organizing around it. That little bit of organization is so much more than any other community has. I mean, I'm very proud of that, but it's also very discouraging.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Come on, guys, get your act together. You can rock the city, but we can't do it alone from Jane and Finch.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're broadcasting more or less out of Jane and Finch over here on the York University campus. So
sure.
All the people listening, you know, if you're concerned about the education of your children, where they're going to be educated, the school closures, you know, be sure to get involved with one of these campaigns.
Well, the best way is to come out on the 18th at Brookview at 6:30.
Mm-hmm.
That's the next ARC meeting.
Okay.
They want to hear delegations. You have to apply to be a delegate. Hell with that. Just stand up at the mic and speak.
That's right.
Tell them what you think. Because none of this is making sense. None of it.
Yeah, just a final question. Like, what can you foresee or have the campaigns articulated, you know, what is going to be the impacts on all these students who are moved out of their schools and put into more crowded schools? Like, What could this lead to in the coming years?
Well, in the coming years, it's going to be interesting because the population will grow up. Right in this area, there's a possibility of 1,000 housing units at Sentinel and Finch. 1,000. New ones being created.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay. They're going to need schooling. The schoolings in the area are packed. They're going to have to go somewhere else. They'll probably be bused or something like that. I mean, you know, where are you going to find all the classrooms? What are we going to do? Rent them from the developers we sold the schools to? I mean, it
Perhaps.
Makes absolutely no sense. You know? Build on, make a four-story elementary school. Your classroom's on the fifth floor, kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, you know, there is real real issues for the flexibility of it. What happens when your local school all of a sudden gets paved over and they put up townhouses? You know, 5 acres of land, 60 an acre, you can put 300 townhouses on, right?
Mm-hmm.
So...
Well, Errol, thank you. We're running a little short on time, but thank you very much for coming on to Radio Basics here tonight. I understand. Can you give us some of the websites of the groups that are against the school closures that, so
well,
people can get involved?
If you go to mine, you'll find it all. You should find it all. If you're not, email me from there. It's Save Schools, SaveSchools, at WordPress, WordPress.com.
So SaveSchools.wordpress.com.
Yeah.
And I know that people can also check out the campaign for publiceducation.ca.
That's right, right on the end.
All right, Errol Young is a former trustee in the Jane and Finch area, 15 years, if I'm not mistaken, Errol.
Yeah, 15 years.
All right, thank you very much for coming on the show with us tonight.
Thanks, Steve.
All right, take care. Radio Basics, CHOY 105.5. We're going to go to a track, and at the end of the show, we're going to be coming back with another interview with a local activist from the Latino community organization.
Lucho.
Lucho Granados Ceja from Barrio Nuevo, and also an activist out of the church San Lorenzo at Dufferin and Lawrence. They're going to be talking about the solidarity they've been doing with the people of El Salvador.
El Salvador.
And yes, thank you, Chin, for the accentuation. And also, they've been doing a solidarity project with trying to get ambulances down to El Salvador. And the project was almost shut down by the executive committee of city council here in the city of Toronto.
Shame.
Shame. But we're going to, they shut it down through mass action. We're going to be talking to Lucho about how they made that happen. Chin, what do you got for us?
I got a really good song by a Nigerian songwriter, Asa, called Jailer.
Hit us up. Radio Basics, we're back.
But now I'm about to get my own.
Yeah. like one of your own. Maybe for the bout your policies all the time. So you better rearrange your feelings. I'll be good.
CHLY 105.5, we're Radio Basics and we're back. So for our last segment of the show, we're going to be talking with community activist Lucho Granado Ceja from Barrio Nuevo regarding an international solidarity project that they have going with El Salvador. Particularly, the project is run out of the San Lorenzo Anglican Liberation Theology Church out at Dufferin and Lawrence. It's a Latino church here in Toronto. And they have a solidarity mission going with El Salvador to get ambulances down there. But over the last couple of days, they were scared that their project might be shut down by Executive Council of the City of Toronto, but due to mass actions, they reversed that. Lucho, are you on the line with us?
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, man, thanks for being on the line with us tonight, bro. So,
No problem. The
Caravan of Hope, this is the name of the project. Tell us all about it.
So the Caravan of Hope actually started, almost 10 years ago, and it was a project really? About building people-to-people solidarity, something that I'm sure the listeners of Radio Basics are familiar with. It was the idea that, we're not just members of this community or our own particular communities or even of this country, but members of the international community. And it's acknowledgement of the fact that we belong to something that's a little bit bigger than us. And with that in mind, they created this mission called the Caravan of Hope, which sends medical supplies, school supplies down to Central America to help build their capacity for them to be able to meet the needs of their own community.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit different from what a lot of these internationalist missions that people might have heard of before, and I think that's what makes it so special, is that it's not built around the idea of charity, right? That's not the conception around mm-hmm. the Caravan of Hope. The Caravan of Hope is about solidarity. It's about working class communities coming together. And, this is run out of San Lorenzo Latin American Community Center. It's a humble community, right? They're all working class people. There's no big business people who attend this church. These are just regular Latin American folks who subscribe to the ideas of this church, which teaches about solidarity, about companionship, about that the priority of the church should be the poor, the most needy. And they launched this mission to send to school supplies, medical supplies, and been doing it for quite a while. But recently, the Caravan of Hope has been able to secure ambulances. And these ambulances are driven down by volunteers down to El Salvador, not necessarily just to provide the medical mission, but actually to help expand the public health system in El Salvador. And that's what's so important about it. What it is about bringing the ability for midwives to be able to provide services to the remote villages. It's about using these to transport people back and forth for Misión Milagro, that program that helps cure the cataract problem amongst poor populations who otherwise would live their entire lives without being able to see. And these are the kinds of things. So the idea isn't so much that we're going to come down there and we're going to give, you know, this service up here from the developed north, but it's just, again, that acknowledgement that we're in this together and that what we can do here will help you be able to participate in your struggle there.
Lucho, you bring up this topic of the question of the difference between charity versus solidarity. And I think this is a really timely question when people from all around the world are digging into their pockets to contribute to the disaster relief in Haiti. Now, as we've discussed time and time again on the show, especially in the last 3 weeks, people need to question the type of charity work that's being done in Haiti right now, because the international community, so-called, the big countries like Canada and the United States, have a very, very nefarious role that they played in Haiti over the last 6 years. So we have to question those intentions. Now, in relation to this project, Caravan of Hope in El Salvador, what's the difference between the solidarity that you guys are doing in El Salvador and charity, generally speaking? What do you mean by that?
Well, the thing is, it's interesting because actually today the whole concept of internationalism came up because of the situation in Haiti. In fact, I spoke to that during my deputation. What I said is that, you know, that comes from a very genuine place, in a place that needs to be celebrated. The fact that people understand that there are others who are in a situation where that might require some assistance from people here in Canada, and that if we have the ability to do so, that we should do something. Right? But the real difference is what are the intentions? What are the motivations? And solidarity is about facilitating people in their own struggle to be able to meet the challenges of their situation. And there's an interesting quote actually by Paulo Freire that I like to invoke in these kinds of situations, right? Mm-hmm. Like our work should never be about treating people as objects to be saved from a burning building. That true generosity lies in challenging the systems of oppression that actually facilitate generosity in the first place, right? The only way to be charitable is that if there's injustice in the first place.
That's
whereas
right.
Solidarity questions the entire unjust system that results in a situation where people need that kind of charity.
Yeah,
in the first place.
And that's precisely why we have to challenge and question the intentions of Canada and the United States right now. For example, Canada held a reconstruction conference in Montreal last Monday, a week ago, about how they're going to help rebuild Haiti. Well, how can we talk about rebuilding Haiti when the Canadian government and the U.S. government have been involved in destroying Haiti for the last 6 to 10 years, okay, particularly since their occupation of the country? Now, shifting the topic back to El Salvador, how is this kind of solidarity significant right now, say, in El Salvador's history? I understand that you were down there, for example, observing the last elections that happened in El Salvador. What's the national context in El Salvador?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's I was actually on Radio Basics earlier early in the year talking about that. Just that is that El Salvador has, thanks to a popular movement that is built around the FMLN, is able to achieve state power, and they're now in a situation where the FMLN candidate Mauricio Funes is the president, and this is the first time, and well, you could possibly say even since the days of colonization, mm-hmm, that a progressive government is in place. And what they're going through right now is the democratizing of the institutions. They're trying to now change the state that used to almost exclusively serve the ruling classes of El Salvador into a state that at least has the functions of a liberal democracy, so that people can now interact with it and be able to participate in a more complete manner. Whereas before, that there was really, everybody knew who the government worked for, and it certainly wasn't the popular sectors of society. So with that in mind, and in fact, the vice president of El Salvador himself sent a letter to the city of Toronto saying that these kinds of internationalist missions are the things that El Salvador needs right now to build up its own capacity to make the kinds of changes, you know. And one of the major areas of work that El Salvador has been engaged in is in health and healthcare delivery. Mm-hmm. And you know, these ambulances, for example, which and it should be acknowledged, and I want to thank the executive committee for voting to continue to support the program, are now going to be able to go and be part of this and improve the lives of Salvadorians to the point that then they can continue on in their independent, their sovereign mission to change the direction of their country towards a more progressive and in the context of Latin America, which is itself going through an immense amount of change against neoliberalism, against capitalism itself.
Mm-hmm. Now, bringing it back to Toronto, so this
this ambulance portion of the Caravan for Hope project was almost put to a stop or blocked. What happened at Executive Council today, and how did you guys change their minds or help swing them in the direction of favoring the project?
So for people who might not be familiar with the way the city works, what happens is that often when something comes to the table at any of the committees of City Council, it goes through a review at the staff level. So these are you know, the bureaucracy analyzes things, but it does things in a very kind of silo approach, which is like, what are the impacts of the finances, what are the impacts on our city policies and things like that. And so the staff had made a recommendation that this not go on, because it was technically not in keeping with one policy that City Council passed back in 2006 about doing this type of international work, and so they recommended against it. And
they passed a policy in 2006 against international.
Yeah, it's called the International Disaster Relief Policy. And so it's basically, what is the city of Toronto going to do when they are made requests about be it the tsunami, be it an earthquake, okay, be it a hurricane or something like that. And so the city of Toronto doesn't like to donate goods. Okay. What they like to do is donate expertise or time, and they have staff like that and things like that. So anyway, so the staff, in keeping with this policy, made this recommendation that this project not go on, that that there's just too many obstacles and too many implications. And you know what? I'm going to go ahead and say it. And what made the difference was the 50 members who, on one day's notice, from the Latin American community, San Lorenzo community, came out and they filled that committee room, and it made it obvious that there would be consequences, that the city cannot go around and abandon this kind of work, that this is really important to the Latin American community, that the community needs to be respected, that they will make themselves present, that they know how to access City Hall, and that they will be there to make deputations. And so three members of the community made deputations, members of the City Council who have cooperated with the Caravan of Hope and other work that San Lorenzo has done, spoke in favor of it, and it was nearly unanimous. And actually, you know what? I think we should go ahead and say the names of the councillor who stood against this is Norm Kelly. He's on the executive committee, and he was the only one of the executive committee who voted against it.
Okay.
And Councillor Holliday also spoke against it, coming from that position of fiscal conservatism, that the city can't afford to do this or that. And really what we're talking about is an ambulance that is worth $10,000 at the auction block.
And let's get something straight, right? And let's get something straight. They're not actually giving a whole bunch of ambulances to El Salvador, right? Like, what are the? Give us the details of what this program is all about.
So what it is actually one ambulance for the next 4 years that it's donated by EMS, the Emergency Medical Services, a division of the City of Toronto. Mm-hmm. So that one comes of no cost to the Caravan of Hope, who then arranges, you know, the cost of transporting it, of the mechanics, and then finds the volunteers who are willing to do the two-week drive all the way down to El Salvador. And then the other ones that now, the second part of that motion was saying that a not-for-profit group like San Lorenzo has the right of first refusal to buy the ambulances before they go to auction. So we'll be able to fundraise and buy as many ambulances as possible and find the volunteers to go and send them out.
So there will be four donated, but the rest will be purchased, right?
Yeah, the rest will be purchased. And which is in and of itself a community mobilization tool, right? Like, we're talking about the difference between solidarity and charity.
Yes.
The people who work to fundraise for these ambulances understand that this is their way of contributing to the development, the positive political development of El Salvador. It's not just like, we're going to donate $100 here or $10 there.
Right.
No, these are raised by essentially selling pupusas on the weekend. You know, and every pupusa sells for $2, so they sell thousands of these to help fundraise and make that happen. People know that that's what it's for, and that's the big difference, right?
Well, I'm glad to hear about that, man. That's some exemplary internationalism. Now, Lucho, before we sign off, we're running out of time here. I know you're a member of Barrio Nuevo. Maybe you can just give us, in 20 seconds, tell us what that organization is all about and how people can find out more about Barrio Nuevo.
So Barrio Nuevo, it's a community organization. We're grassroots. We're almost all volunteer organization. And what we do is that we work with the Latin American community to try to inspire the kind of social movement that exists in Latin America, the idea that if we want to make change, what we need to do is mobilize in our community, mobilize around the issues that are important to us, things like access to education, things about like social economic marginalization, and saying that the solutions lie through organization. The solutions lie in three words that we use: unidad, organización, and lucha. That's unity, organization. so that we're going to come together and we're going to make that fight, and we're going to make it known that that when it comes to things that our community needs or things that other communities, that we're going to be present, and present be it in the media, on the radio, present on the streets in a march, or present in the halls of power at City Hall like we demonstrated today.
Well, man, on that note, brother, all power to the people, man. Thanks for being on the radio with us tonight.
Absolutely, thanks for having me. And if people want to get in touch, it's just barrionova.canada@gmail.com.
All right, much respect.
Bye, Lucho.
Thank you very much.
David Chin taking us out with a track. What do you got, brother?
It's a song called On Palestine by a blues group from, I think, Memphis.
All right, man. On Palestine. Just reminding our listeners that if you don't already know, Radio Basics is the radio wing of Basics Free Community Newsletter. We got our new website up and online. You can check it out at basicsnews.ca. All our new content. We got our this radio program, Radio Basics, streamlined into it. You can check out all our shows. Our archived shows will be linked off the website. And all of our new news features always posted to the website. And it's also where you'll find all the content of Basics Free Community Newsletter. Earlier in the show, we did an interview with Errol Young, speaking about the proposed school closures by the TDSB. He recently published an article on basicsnews.ca that you can also check out. So that's all I got for tonight. I don't know about you, Chin.
Yeah, we had Glenn Ford.
We also had Glenn Ford talking.
On Haiti.
On courtesy of Russian RT, Russian Television News or something like
something
that.
Something like that.
Yeah, Glenn Ford talking on Haiti. So we'll be back next week. I don't know, Dave Chin, Justin Panos, Kabir Joshi Vijayan, myself, Steve DeSilva. I don't know who's going to be here. Somebody will be.
I have no idea.
But this is where you can find us every Monday night, 8 to 9 p.m., Radio Basics, Basics Free Community Newsletter, basicsnews.ca. We're out.
Child of man, in times gone by, faces of stone, lion heart and sigh. On Sunday day, they all came home. All that they had was burning gone. The timber men, their pistols gleam, a lifetime lost on Palestine. He would not run. He dropped the hope, picked up the gun. And then one night he disappeared. He feared the worst of all their fear. They found him quiet in a tree. He flew away from Palestine. The day they moved away, more guns.
not stay. A Brooklyn St. Mary to all us came, but we still dream of Palestine.